Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to an edition of Speaking of Reliability. This is Adam Barrett.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl, how's it going?
Going pretty well, Adam.
So we did our last episode, and then we wanted to do a follow-on on a related topic. And I'm kind of excited about it because I have a feeling I'm going to learn a lot on this one as you you share your parameter diagram and how it's used in programs.
Sure, sure. This is on the topic of design for reliability. A lot of the reliability activities have to focus around design in order to meet fast to market, high reliability, low cost, all the different objectives we have to integrate. You know, years back, we used to get two of those three. Now we got to meet budget, you got to meet timing, and you need to meet reliability objectives. And the only way you can do that is to integrate design for reliability along with your testing methods and other things you have to do from a testing standpoint. And one of the tools that supports design for reliability is parameter diagram. And parameter diagram really started, if you go into Duran's books, you'll see initial concepts around P-diagrams. And he talked a lot about it as a way to determine which variables can be adjusted in order to achieve design or manufacturing. I don't know, it's an example of parameter diagram, but I thought it'd be fun to chat about it and see where we think parameter diagram might fit into a reliability program. And if we had an audience that we could see, I'd love to ask you to raise your hands if you're listening to this, and let us know whether or not you have experience with parameter diagrams. So maybe that's a follow-up.
Yeah, no, I love this because when people ask me, you know, what is reliability, if you were to say it in one sentence, I say it's the study and control of variability. You know, you start off with a design that works and does what it's supposed to do, but that's under everything being nominal. So what happens as all the possible things that can vary do vary?
Sure. And if we look at the classical definition, reliability has four elements. The probability, so there's some probability associated with it, that the item will meet its intended functions. So there's a functional element. Understated conditions, so there's the conditions and operating environment and customer usage over a period of time. And parameter diagram, interestingly enough, models two or three of those. You have the functions as input signals and the ideal response. The ideal response meaning that the primary intended functional output occurs. Then you also model the external environment, the customer usage. And then you also model in your visual diagram the control factors, the knobs that the designer can use to affect the functions. So it's really interesting how it kind of comes together in that parameter diagram.
Yeah, yep. What's one recently you've done? Let's dig into one.
Sure, sure. I can't talk proprietary, but I can say that a pump, just leave it generic, in terms of the application and the company, but a pump has input signals. In other words, it has certain pressures and certain characteristics of fluid and things like that that go into the pump system. And then it has a response where it actually elevates the pressure or it accomplishes some specific result in terms of a volume of flow and pressures, that type of thing. And so in the parameter diagram, we looked at what we call the noise factors, which includes the piece-to-piece variation of the parts of the pump. It includes the degradation of the materials in the pump. It includes the duty cycle of the pump, how often it's used and under what stresses. It includes the external environment of the pump, which means, you know, the temperatures and humidities and dust and other environmental aspects that are given. as well as system interactions, where you can have, if a pump has a controller and there might be different system interactions that can interrupt the pump. Those are what's characterized in a P diagram and what Juran characterized as noise factors.
Yep. Okay. So what do you, I mean, so then the big question is, all right, that's overwhelming from a program perspective to imagine studying all of those and figuring out how to control them. What's, you know, how would you approach finding which ones you do want to study in your limited
sure.
time?
Sure. In the limited time. So we would identify some of whatever the team thinks are important, piece to piece variation or customer usage, duty cycle, external environment, just identify what is most important. Then start identifying the design parameters that can be changed to affect the results. So in a very simple example, I used to test back in the 80s in door testing, we used to test door impact beams. So we'd put the impact beam that's between the sheet metal and the inner panel of the door on a fixture and we'd push on it, force deflection, to see if it was strong enough to withstand an accident. And then we decided, rather than push on it and test it, what if we controlled the diameter and the material of the impact beam? And sure enough, those turned out to be the design parameters, the diameter and the material composition of the impact beam, that if controlled, you get the ideal response, which is the force deflection curve. So that's just another example. So just to be simple on this, you get the control factors, like I'm describing. Then one of the values of the parameter diagram is you identify the error states, which are the loss of energy transfer. And those become, if you're doing an FMEA, those become failure modes in the FMEA. So that's just a simple application that I've used on a pump.
Yeah, that's good. That's interesting. So a lot of it is focused around what you know, you finding out what you know you can change and not studying things that you won't be able to change.
Yeah, exactly. I see people oftentimes think that it got too hot as the cause of the problem. No, getting too hot is an environment.
Yep.
What the cause of the problem is, what's the design weakness, design deficiency that makes it vulnerable to getting hot?
Right.
So, right. So sometimes when you make these visual, in a parameter diagram is to make it visible. That's all it is. You can do a P diagram in less than an hour. At a high level, and it makes the system visible so that when you work in reliability, you can focus on the right parameters and you can talk the language of the designers.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the next thing is actually figuring out the ranges of those values. I mean, that's a whole another endeavor is you say, okay, we know that temperature can have a big effect and we have to figure out how to handle how it varies. All right. What are the ranges? And you have, you know, that can sometimes be also quite daunting to then say, all right, we have to go out in the field and do metrology or try to model it with something like finite element analysis or other tools.
Yeah, this is very much the subject of robust design. Years ago, we used to think we just have to reduce variation and everything and we'll get higher reliability. But reducing variation can be very expensive. If you can determine where your design is sensitive to anticipated variation, you can adjust design parameters to make it less sensitive, which is less costly than merely focusing on variation reduction.
Oh, yeah. Not to mention, you might spend a ton of money trying to hit everything. And, you know, of course, you can't. And then you miss the ones that are the ones that matter. And this is where, like, design of experiments is fantastic to find correlations that do matter. And, you know, to, again, direct resource towards where you'd study and then try to control it.
Yeah, excellent. And it's the language of robust design, which, interestingly enough, is a whole subject in itself, that different people have different definitions of robust design. You go into one circle and robust design is bigger, tougher, stronger. And in another circle, robust design is insensitive to anticipated variation. I typically like to use the latter definition.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really neat. And then there's, of course, if you can't study, and then trying to get as much of this information from historical, you know, legacy products, because they have effectively done studies in the sense that the units have been run in all those variabilities. But the big question is getting the data and turning into useful information, because that data can be so noisy. The amount of energy that goes into scrubbing old data sets that weren't really well structured, you know, well structured, you know, let's say metrology type applications can be so hard. I have one example that's it always breaks my heart. They have like they literally have over a million units in the field. They're smaller electronic units that are effectively left on their own. So you have this opportunity for a tremendous amount of data, and the units also do wirelessly communicate information. But they were never set up to communicate the information that would be really helpful for diagnosis. Their job is to send, you know, a signal. And really, the only way you know they failed is they stopped sending it. But then when their maintenance is done, or they go out to address an issue because they have units that are bad, the people that are doing it are twice removed from the actual company. So it's a subcontractor of a subcontractor. And they'll go out there to fix a unit, but replace another 8, 9, or 10 of them just because they're already out there to save time. So you have 10 failures when really there was one, and you know nothing about really the root cause of any of them, and most of the evidence has been destroyed. So it's
like, oh wow, that's a great case study you're describing.
It's horrible.
You covered a lot of ground there, Adam.
Oh man, and so what I'm trying to have the company pursue, and I'm hoping the pain they've experienced will motivate it because it's a big investment, but creating an app for a phone, because all these people, you know, even though they're subcontractors, have phones, right? And it's not hard to, when you take the unit out, scan the barcode, type in a few notes about what you see, take a picture of what's around it. I mean, right there is a tremendous amount of information. And, you know, then you can, and it instantly would upload to a database. So you basically have a live database of a lot of detailed information, really without inconveniencing the people who are acquiring it at all. There's no special equipment or procedures or... It simply doesn't count as, you know, a field removal until that information is in there. And I think that's a simple solution. It requires foresight, right, and taking time to develop that and implement it in that cost. But if you compare that against the expense of not knowing what's happening right now or being able to study it, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, I wanted to back up, and good points you're making, and just ask you something you mentioned earlier about design of experiments. Well, here's where we could do a DOE to find out the main effects and that type of thing. What, in your experience, Adam, what triggers a DOE? When do you, it's a wonderful tool. When do you use it?
So I think that, you know, the alternative is the OFAT, right? One factor at a time. And that's, of course, the type of testing we've all been doing since we were 5 years old. You know, you try to hold everything else constant and just change one variable and see how the response changes. And that's what people go to quite often. Two issues with that. One, you've already made a very strong assumption as to what you think is controlling it. So a lot of times you can find a correlation, even if there isn't really one, you know, without doing a well-designed single-factor experiment. And secondly, you're completely missing any opportunity to see interactions. And interactions being, if you're changing two variables, it might be that changing variable, the first one from A to B, doesn't do anything. Changing a second variable from A to B doesn't do anything. But if they're both B, that's when it happens. And you'll never catch that doing one factor at a time. So I pull out design of experiments pretty quickly because it also generally produces information very fast. So I do that whenever there is any kind of hesitation as to the real root cause of something. I say, okay, let's stop and identify what variables could be affecting it. Let's try to trim that down to two or three, and then let's create a design of experiments.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good, very good. So circling back on P diagram, let's think about, and one of the things I love about podcasting is we're actually learning as we go here. Let's think about when we would use P diagram. So P diagram is a nice visual technique to show the inputs and outputs and the control factors and the noises and the error states. So we've said we don't want to use reliability tools always on everything. I mean, there's literally 100 or more reliability tools, so you don't want to use them all on every program. So when would we use a P diagram? What do you think?
Well, I think it comes out with that similar type of question where so let's say it's reactive. Something has occurred. And we know that design works. We make 5 of them in test stands. They work no problem. So we're clearly not finding the variability that is driving that percentage failure mode. So, which leaves you stuck with, okay, we need 1,000 of them that we test in 1,000 different environments, you know, every possible variation. So that's exhausting. So I think the P diagram is very powerful in the sense of bringing that in the focus of what you want to study. Okay, what are all the variabilities? What do we think the ranges are? And which ones do we think will have the greatest effect on having, as you said, the system function being the input signal turning to the response? So I think it brings great focus to trimming that down so that you can try to pursue what the cause and effect is that's driving the issue.
Yeah, makes sense. I typically like to use P-diagram on the more complex systems, but wherever you want to have a robust design or you want to make your design work in spite of noises, that can be a good place for it. And interestingly enough, when you mentioned DOE, is because obviously part of DOE is getting that signal-to-noise ratio where it needs to be, and or at least in Taguchi methods, one form of DOE. And the PIA diagram might be a nice input to a DOE as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that, yeah, because with both of those, I described initially parsing down what is it you want to study. So those two definitely would go hand in hand, because that's the next thing with the DOE after you select your factors is what are the levels, right? What are the different, you can't have 50 different levels, you know, you can't have 10 degrees C temperature increments, you know, times right. seven. You need to right. basically pick three, right? So what are the three that are meaningful? You know, the range that the failure is occurring at may not be evident.
Right. And so what are those three? And then what values do we put for those three?
Right, exactly. And the P diagram, I think, would the process of creating it would be a great way to get that, you know, resolution and range that's going to tell you the most in the design of experiments.
I'm on these, a lot of the standards bodies, like I'm working on the reliability program standard for SAG 41 and also the FMEA standard. And it's interesting that P diagram shows up on both. From an FMEA standpoint, a lot of companies are using P diagram as an input to FMEA, not all of them. And I wouldn't make it an absolute requirement, but it's certainly something to consider. If you have the risk that makes FMEA valuable, in other words, it's the right tool to use, then you can consider adding P-diagram as one of the inputs.
Yeah, that's actually really neat. I really haven't thought about that in making that, like advising that to be part of the process to say, hey, let's definitely do a P-diagram before the DFMEA. I've never said that, but now in talking with you, like I said, I knew I was going to learn something in this conversation. I think that is something I will advise directly.
Sure, certainly consider it. An FMEA block diagram, I always require a P diagram as optional, but in certain circumstances, it can be a great input to FMEA. Some of those control factors end up as inputs to causes, like you don't have the right diameter, you don't have the right material. Some of the noise factors can be inputs to the mechanisms that end up in failure, and the error states in the P diagram map one-to-one with failure modes.
Yeah. I know you said that you're going to put this in the show notes, which is fantastic. So for people who are, you know, not listening on their drive to work, if you are, please don't look at the diagram. But if they're home listening to the podcast, I'm sure some people will still, but I just wanted to not be accountable. It definitely can pull it up and see what we're talking about, because and if you're not familiar with it, definitely become familiar with it. It's very, I think, easy to implement and really powerful. So it's good. Well, that's great. Well, I'm really glad we had this discussion, and I definitely learned a lot in it.
Well, I thank you very much. I appreciate the discussion as well. I learned some things too.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Everybody, please feel free to leave comments. We love seeing them. And we look forward to sharing our next topic with you. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.